Hello, everybody, and welcome to GM Party, episode 106, where we talk about music and RPGs. We're here with, a bunch of people. We've got Alistair Stewart, Jason Pitt, and Josh Jordan talking about, and of course, your eponymous host, Andy Burdan, and we will start with introductions. Let's just go Google Hangouts style, left to right. I'll start with Alistair.
Hi, everyone. I'm Alistair Stewart. I wear a lot of hats. The one which is directly relevant to this podcast is I am a freelance tabletop RPG module and sourcebook writer. I've done a bunch of stuff for the Doctor Who RPG. I've done some work for Primeval. I'm most of the way through my first chunk of stuff for Infinity. And I'm working with Jason on After the War, which is an original property, which we're having just ridiculous amounts of fun with.
Beautiful. Jason.
I'm Jason Pitt, tabletop RPG publisher and designer, working on far too many games, and one of which is After the War, because it's a memetic science fiction horror game about sentient song, so it's kind of on theme. And working with Alistair is, as he said, a ridiculous amount of fun. So yeah. And in my spare time, I also run the RPG Design Panelcast, which is a podcast of RPG design and publishing related panels and seminars.
Beautiful. Josh.
Hi, I'm Josh Jordan. Let's see. Well, I am the game designer behind Ginger Goat Publishing, and including games like Heroine and Singularity, and more recently, The Impostors. I think the most relevant one right now is probably a short film in which one character is basically in charge of the soundtrack for the game. That's one of their main jobs. And then I'm working on various games right now. The biggest one is probably John Silence. So just because I'm playing or working on a game with silence in the name doesn't mean I don't have opinions on music.
Very cool. And I'm Andy Burdan. For those new to the stream, I run this GM Party debacle, and it's I'm working on a game called Mic Drop, where I'm trying to sort of create the experience that the actors had when filming Spinal Tap. It's crazy improv, sort of 80s rock band tour, dysfunctional band member stuff. It's good fun. All right. So that's our introductions out of the way, and let's talk about some particular topics. Now, Josh, you mentioned you had a soundtrack role within your game. I'm curious as to how you've mechanized music in the rules.
Well, short film is a... Well, I'm looking at the rules right here. It's a 6-page long game, so you know that it's super detailed and very crunchy. The idea behind it is basically I wanted a 4-player game where it felt like you and your friends are making a short film. So there's a character whose title is the locations player, one who's the star player, and they basically are acting as the main actor in the movie. There's a casting player who sort of changes hats and plays as a lot of the different characters. And there's a soundtrack character who they basically, part of what they do is they start and they end the game. And they also can start and end new scenes by means of the soundtrack. Like basically we're playing, I've got my phone, I'm the soundtrack player, or we're playing on Hangouts and I've got access to some sort of streaming video service, perhaps YouTube, and I'm in charge of, okay, the game begins here with some song from the Spinal Tap soundtrack. And that does a lot in my experience towards setting the mood or the theme of the game, even without necessarily communicating in words specifically what feel you're going for.
Very cool. How about you, Jason? How have you mechanized sound or music in your game designs?
So I'll start off and then ping it over to Al. Because it's a joint project, it's exciting that way. So in our game, effectively, song is a transmission vector that unifies people and brings them into a choir, a collective hive mind. So music becomes a force of unification that is too strong for an individual to resist. So music becomes a source of horror, which taps something deep down from a cultural perspective. And so accordingly, music is effectively the antagonist that can actually warp your mind. If the GM wins in a conflict against the players, they can say, oh, consolation prize, you get whatever you wanted. But I'm going to twist your beliefs without your awareness and change and my control. So that's sort of the musical core of the game. Al.
Yeah. The basic idea behind this came from kind of two or three different experiences. I'm not sure how much of this I've ever told, Jason. I grew up on the Isle of Man, which is a small scrap of land halfway between the UK and Ireland. And by small, I mean it's 30 kilometers long. You can walk down it in a day. If any of you are familiar with the old British sitcom Father Ted, dial that down by maybe 25%. That's basically where I grew up. And it's a place of terminuses. It's not quite English. It's not quite Irish. It is all coast. It's all rural. And that got me really interested in the, for want of a better word, this, that kind of combination of small town horror and the unspeakable things that live just out past the edge of small town horror. And I always remember one of my first experiences as a kid was going into, or was being taken into the local Anglican church for a harvest festival. There was no Wicker Man. They waited until 18 before they took us to the Wicker Man festival. So it was all good. And I had a panic attack. I was just this like 3 foot tall, hairless Ewok looking at these colossal stainless steel windows full of people with serious eyes and spears. And it was just the volume of cultural input, the volume of information being crammed into my brain was entirely too high, and I just maxed out. And I've always thought about that moment in connection with after the war, and the idea that maybe cross-checked a little bit with the original concept for the Cenobites in the Clive Barker Hellraiser stories. The idea that something music, something which is so inherently unifying, when pushed all the way past that terminus, becomes unifying and all pervasive in the worst possible way. And that really interested me. Also around the same time, there were, I think, three science fiction movies I saw entirely too young, all of which had a very long standing effect on me. One was Aliens, one was The Terminator, and one was the 1993 version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And I've ended up becoming this kind of amateur Invasion of the Body Snatchers historian, where I've watched every version, including the Nicole Kidman one, which no one, including the crew, I think, ever made it through the end of. And the one which always stuck in my mind was that 1993 one, because so much of it is about conformity and universality. And it's the take on the story where the sales pitch, if you like, for the pod people is best focused. And the idea of relaxing into conformity, the idea of it's better over here, which of course Stephen King expresses in It, Everything Floats Down Here. That's horror at its rawest and most insidious. And I really like that. And my brain being my brain, it took those early experiences on the Isle of Man, the Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and I think a good chunk of Hans Zimmer's Interstellar soundtrack, and just kind of mashed them all together. And that was the initial concept that was put in front of Jason for After the War, and we've developed it and run with it ever since.
Very cool. I'm curious as to the connections between the horror and the dystopic sort of themes that you've got going there. It really picked out ideas for my brain from like Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, where that drug-induced conformity is sort of seductively encouraged.
Yes.
Is that sort of like the musical vector that you have?
One of the kind of throwaway topics which comes up in After the War, one of the things we've done is scattered a lot of kind of after-action testimony from NPCs who experienced the war in various levels and various dimensions through the book. And one of those is the captain of the survey vessel that makes this catastrophically successful first contact with the Song. And one of the points he makes is, once he was cured of it and once the war was over, he was shown the medical telemetry from the moment where the Song took them over. And at the exact same second, every crew member's pulse drops. And that's one of the keys in the game to why the Song is as insidious as it is. It's like the line from The Prestige about drowning. It feels like coming home. You want this. It just feels right. And that idea of curdling, that feeling of warmth and reassurance, and also curdling one of the purest cultural forms there are, is really what drives the background of the game.
That's very cool.
And from a purely like mechanical at the table perspective, the most beautiful form of horror that you can pull off is, oh, those small children are singing. Oh my God, panic attack.
Yes.
Because a group of children are singing.
And of course, that ties back into the old Eddie Izzard gag about how if horror movie characters could listen to the soundtrack, they'd all make it to the end of the movie. You know, I mean, horror is largely my day job. I host Pseudopod, a weekly horror fiction podcast, and not a week goes by where, you know, I don't hear Eddie Izzard in the back of my brain going, ah, I died tragically, ah, you know.
That's awesome.
To segue into that, Josh, I'm curious if you've given some thought to how the soundtrack is perceived by the characters in the short film.
Ooh, that's a good idea. I think, so for short film specifically, I tried to make it like on a scale of more mechanically crunchy games, which I like, to more sort of loosey-goosey ones. Short film is definitely more loosey-goosey. It's a lot of like, look, did you know that you don't need a GM if everyone has a very specific rule? Like, it's kind of, some of my games, I think, come across as relatively, like, I think of them as opportunities to preach at people who think RPGs can only be one way, which is maybe not the most healthy way to approach game design, but it is a way. And I can name some other designers who do the same thing. So short film, my particular axe to grind was, you can play a game that does not feel GM-less if everyone has a different job, because you know exactly what you're supposed to be doing and you are in charge of the thing in front of you. And if you trust that the game is designed at least halfway decently, then you can make it through the whole thing and you don't necessarily need someone bossing you around. Now, that's not a knock at GM games. I love those too. It's just sort of the, did you know you could do it this way? So your question, sort of the, to use a big fat fiction word, like, is the music diegetic or extra diegetic, or what would be the implications of if the characters could recognize the music? I think in a particular session, that would be a lot of fun, especially maybe if you were going for more of a comedy feel, and maybe if I were the cast player, like if I were the main character in this short film that we were creating together, realizing partway through the game session that I could tell, it's like, oh, my best friend's probably about to die because we just switched to really melancholy sort of 90s alt rock. It's like this, whatever's about to happen is supposed to make me cry. I think that would be fun, but I don't think you like that's sort of a group dynamics. Like, is everybody willing to laugh at themselves? I think it probably varies from session to session whether we're all in the mood for that sort of self-reflection or not. But it's a good suggestion. I'm going to try it next time.
It might be a good candidate for an advanced rule set.
Sure.
Here's some optional things to try.
Yeah.
And I'm just saying, Deadpool.
Yeah.
I mean,
the fourth wall thing. Like, it's so comic book.
Totally. Yeah, I tend to enjoy that sort of like the occasional breaking of the fourth wall, depending on the genre of the story. Deadpool is a good example of like, let's actually talk at the audience, or Ferris Bueller or something like that, where like we are fully aware of the medium that we're using and the characters are too.
Oh, the Arrested Development, the Office camera look, choice.
Yeah, it's like...
I actually saw that specific power in Don't Rest Your Head.
Oh.
Someone had the ability to change the soundtrack. That was their madness power.
Nice.
That's great.
I like that.
Oh, I just realized I haven't talked about my stuff yet.
Yeah, you should do that.
I should do that. Right. So
and then turn it up to 11.
Yes, naturally. So mic drop is, I guess, effectively GM-less. The idea is you go through and build your band with all sorts of sort of fiasco-like connections between all the different characters. You pick a role, you state what kind of dysfunctional relationship you have to every one of the other players in game, or characters in game. And at the end of the band creation, you go into an interview where effectively Rob Reiner, played by the game itself, is interviewing you of what happened during the last album tour you were on, which went down in a smoking ruin of a tour. So you're prompted by the game. This shit happened. What happened? How did you deal with it? This happened. How did you deal with it? But you've already got this setup of dysfunction to lean on. So it's in terms of mic drop and musical mechanics for playing the game, there's not really a whole lot of mechanical aspects that deal with music. It's more about musical culture, I guess. The group interaction, the fact that you're on a tour and entertaining other people. So for mechanical aspects of it, the music is more used as a trope, a theme.
I get that. That sounds great.
Yeah.
Does the genre of music, like say we're playing mic drop, like to what extent, either on the character sheet if there is one or in the conversation of the game, does it come up what kind of band it is? Like, does that factor in at all?
Yeah, that's the first step. In the first step, before you build those relationships, it's essentially a four-phase game. First phase is you work together as a group and decide what the group does. So genre, group name, album name, tour name, and then you work on your individuals. That's phase two. And then you have that band. That's essentially the first act, is those two phases. Second act is the band's rise to popularity during that tour. Third act is how did the tour end up becoming a smoking ruin?
That sounds fantastic. And you could mod that quite easily to do something like Mozart in the Jungle, to do it with like orchestra facing instead. Hmm. I mean, I could see that being mappable across the LARP quite easily as well.
That would totally be LARPable.
Yeah.
Especially Nordic. Just like super sad, depressing, everyone at each other's throats with knives. I mean, yeah.
I could see, like, rules as written sounds good, but one of the things I might push for would be playing it as, like, either a touring high school band or a touring high school choir, because then you have sort of the, like, okay, what are we doing? Where are we doing it? And it's like, oh, it was going so well, and then, like, doing it with a Spinal Tap band would be great, but from my own personal history, like, I can imagine a high school band or choir tour going down in flames, and that would be a fun story to tell too.
Yeah, that's absolutely doable in the framework. Now, the roles might have to be adjusted slightly because the roles are sort of responsibility oriented. So mm-hmm. you've got the talent. And you've got the drummer, you've got the rookie, but there, you also have the manager and the roadie and all sorts of different characters that interact that definitely are oriented more towards a professional performer. Well, professional, let's be fair. But it's a nice adaptation. I like that. And I think that's the only thing that would have to change was those particular roles.
I think I could make that happen. I think, like, the first of all, when I was in high school choir, I was a professional because they paid me occasionally. But we did funerals and all that kind of awesome stuff. But yeah, I mean, some things would obviously have to change, and the power dynamics are a little different, but I think it's doable. That would be fun. And of course, the whole idea is it's not a well-functioning group by the end of the story, so even if it doesn't fit exactly right, if everybody knows what they're doing, then we can watch it crash and burn together.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yes, and there's actually a similar game design that Jason Morningstar did. But it's actually a one player choose your own adventure battle the metal bands game.
Well, there's one that's a LARP where you you play the different bands and you assemble at Battle of the Bands and you LARP out your experiences, but hand wave the performance or actually do the performance. I talked with Alex Roberts about this, and it was a bit inspiring. Yeah, what's the one that you were talking about?
I'm trying to recall. I have a copy of it. It's one of those like short limited releases.
Right.
So I've got a physical copy somewhere, but it isn't even on their website. I just took a quick look. But it's nice to know that there's other games out there. So the question is, does your game include the ability to come up with fictional song names
and
make up songs during play? Because I totally want to see that effing asshole when you have a conflict in the band and that becomes one of your songs.
I forgot the best part. So one of the strongly recommended optional rules, I may incorporate it and make it actually a required rule. I haven't quite decided yet. But anytime during the tour, when a conflict comes up, somebody in the band is required to post a subtweet about it in character.
Nice.
So the I've run the playtest of the game, and everyone made persona accounts on Twitter with their characters, and like we played the game for a week. And it was incredible. The kinds of like back and forth snark that happened. It was amazing. And it really cemented a lot of the ideas. And to some degree, the game is an exploration of fame and how publicity figures into parts of the social dynamic of the group.
Right.
You have to deal with your conflict and be open with your fans, but also not be open with your fans because you're a train wreck. And sometimes people want to see the train wreck and sometimes they don't. You have to manage that. And, you know, creatives are sensitive individuals.
No, never.
So, you know, being available to your fans and not available to your fans is an interesting dynamic to play with.
There's another Jason Morningstar game, and I'm trying to think of the name, and I'm trying to look on the website, that is relevant, Andy, to what you're talking about, in that it is it is not about music, but the format is somewhat similar in that one character plays someone who is interviewing a group of people after things have gone horribly wrong. And if I could figure out what it is, I'll share the name with you. Just for out of pure curiosity, you might take a look. Not that your game is going to be mechanically in any way similar, but it might be interesting. Like basically the idea is that this group of people were serving overseas and like in a humanitarian organization, and that they have are all in the airport on their way back to the States. And one random passerby comes and asks them about their experience, and it is clear that the experience is horrible. And I played it one time at a convention, and I got to be the interview, like the person who didn't know anything, and I had a great time accidentally making the other players cry, which was so. It's like, really, what was that like? Derp derp. And so, in terms of the interview after a tragedy game, I have had at least one positive experience, so I would be happy to check out Mic Drop. It's so far I'm batting 100 or batting 1,000.
Very cool. Yeah, I've been meaning to get Jason on this show for a while and talk to him at PAX Unplugged, and just haven't managed to get the times to work. But definitely seems like this episode, at least, it's like, well, why aren't you one of these icons at the bottom of the screen here? Very cool. All right. Let's dive into particular game discussions here. One of the things that I like to do on GM Party is, because we have so many game designers in one place, it's helpful to, instead of just talking in general terms about the game, start diving into issues that may have blocked us in the design. It's like, I'm having this problem. Does anybody have any opinions? And sort of get some ideas or concepts. I've sort of already talked about that a little bit with my social media stuff. So I will just launch into that, just to break the ice a little bit for y'all. With Mic Drop, the social media aspect of it is compelling as a concept, but in terms of mechanizing that for the players, I'm having a little bit of an issue. Sort of bridging that that genre gap. It's like you're sitting down at a table, playing a game, talking with your friends, or on Roll20 or Google Hangouts or whatever, and pulling away the attention from the conversation at table to pull out your phone and dick around with Twitter, and also have that brought back into the game as people see your responses in character. And that sort of aspect is confusing and not necessarily as smooth. I don't want to make a custom social media app that is just for this game, although I have considered it. having that sort of out of table, in table experience, I think is important, but it's a barrier that is causing me issues right now. If anybody has any opinions, I'd love to hear them.
Yeah, I have a couple. The first thing that strikes me is it might be worth, if you can, time shifting the social media element of it. And there's actually a really interesting and surprisingly successful real world example of this. For the last few years, in between being visibly terrified by any concept of what to do with their female performers, the WWE has actually been doing really interesting stuff with social media. Basically, the moment they realized tout wasn't a thing and they were starting to look a little bit silly and that, you know, Twitter was happening, they actually built what seems to be a secondary writer's room into their Twitter accounts. And you've seen entire angles unfold and resolve between wrestlers online. And it's worked brilliantly because essentially what they've done is created a secondary stream of content, which is completely free, informs the primary stream of content, and is completely optional. So, and better still, they don't have to pay anybody for it because, I mean, you know, Vince is kind of like Mickey Mouse. That's why he has three fingers. Can't pick up the check. And that's a really, really good example of something which could work very well with this, where, say, I am very much spitballing here. In the kind of the pre-prep for the game, if you perhaps shifted the phases around so the band was created prior to the others, you set up kind of maybe some events that you'd like to see unfold through these Twitter accounts, had them bounce around in there, and then brought those to the table to power the later phases. That might work really well because then you're not distracting from the kind of actual sit down play, but at the same time, you're still getting the extra element to it. There's a game, and I can't quite remember what it's called, but I do remember the name of the guy who designed it. Nate Pauletta did a fantastic professional wrestling simulation game.
Yep.
Where you play the entire crew. You have wrestlers, you have commentators, you build the angles, you build the plots. And that doesn't quite take... Oh, Jason's going for it. That doesn't quite take the same kind of time-shifted approach, but might be useful, just as an example of something which might be another road to get to where you need to be.
Yeah, that's interesting. The so setting up a sort of secondary stream,
yep,
part of character creation, effectively, does sound particularly compelling and stitches things together nicely.
To go along with that, I just have two questions. One is this a game that mic drop that has multiple sessions typically, or is it a one shot? And how long are the sessions theoretically or typically?
That's a good question. It's changed over time. Originally, it was intended to be a slow play game where it was meant to be micro sessions that are primarily played on social media, and you don't sit at a table at all.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you play entirely on Twitter, resolve things on Twitter, and you have a GM account that provides the Rob Reiner sort of mechanization. It was interesting. It didn't feel as compelling. People drifted off. It basically felt like play by post where you have people dropping in and dropping out. And it wasn't as engaging as I wanted it to be. Bringing the table back into it helped people keep focused. The table, I've only been considering it as a one-shot sort of experience to keep that tight focus structured in terms of, like, an interview is actively the event that is happening, and you are reminiscing about the album tour that happened. So it certainly could be multiple sessions, and each session could be a separate interview, a separate interviewer talking about the previous tour, and then you could add on elements of the tour or go on another tour and repeat that. I haven't explored that in playtesting. It's been cloudy thoughts.
Have you considered doing almost a Night Witch's style two phases of play? So you have effectively at the table times and then social media times. So on tour and off tour or something along those lines.
Oh, that's interesting.
So you could have, here is 45 minutes of play at the table. Now we have 15 minutes of, you can take a bio break or use Twitter or whatever social media. And then you bring the band back together. And effectively having forced, here is the at the table time. Here is the antisocial not at the table time.
That's interesting.
Which would also encourage one delightful, terrible dynamic that is good. So you get the slacker who just relaxes and goes and gets a coffee and just doesn't pay attention. And then you get the people who are really engaged, who come to decisions and have opinions and have been talking full stop for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And then bring them all back together. If you want dysfunction, that's a good way to do it.
Very good point. Yes.
You can also mechanize engagement on those social media things. Whoever has the most retweets or favorites, well, the fans want this.
Right.
Which would encourage people making attention grabbing things.
Yeah.
Over quality things.
Yeah, the clickbait posts.
Yep.
Absolutely.
If you divided it into phases like Jason's suggesting, one way that you could play that out, if the group chooses, is the, like, we're setting things up at the table, then social media, and then the interview part. You could do this part at the, you know, phase one, we are setting up the band and we're talking about our rise to glory, and then next week we're going to come back and do the interview. And I like Jason's idea of the social media is this 15-minute session within our normal group meeting, but you could just as well stretch that middle part out and say we're scheduling the before and we're scheduling the after, and if you like, when you can this week, post as Guy Slammer, the group drummer, and as much as you want, complain about the management. And like, that might minimize the drift that you were saying of just a sort of play by post game. But you could give the group the choice of whether they want to do it all in one night or over like two sessions.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of turning it into campaign play and spreading it out. That's going to need some testing. I'm going to try that.
I'm just about to drop a YouTube link in the chat window, which is a strange thing to do. But there is an MC Frontalot song and video, which weirdly has a couple of ideas about how to possibly turn something like this into campaign play.
I'm just going to paste that into the public chat because they're not linked. Oh. All right. Very cool. I will take a look at that. But not now, because we're talking. fantastic ideas. Thanks, guys. Now I've been dominating the mic, so let's move it over to any of you. Do you have any particular roadblocks that you would like to talk about?
Who wishes to approach council for wisdom?
Well, since I'm noodling it, let's pass this off to Josh.
Okay. Okay, so the game that I'm working on right now is John Silence. The short pitch for it is, what if you played a yet another D&D clone, except the diplomacy section was this big and the combat section was this big? So mechanically...
Sold.
Yeah, so like I like regular D&D just fine, but what if mechanically you said, okay, kill someone is a skill check, convince them that you're right is an entire chapter out of the book. And the different classes have, instead of like ranged and melee, they have sort of like debate and friendship. So like you're either sort of long-term trying to convince them to be your buddy, and here are some things that you get if you succeed, or short-term, let me tell you why you need to do this favor for me right now, and you have the equivalent of hit points, yada, yada, yada. Okay, so if you're playing that game, and I'm familiar that you're all at least, passingly familiar with a game like D&D or, you know, basic roleplay or any of the other games like that are sort of old school, we are slowly progressing towards defeating this enemy, and we either pass or succeed, and that probably means they die if we succeed. So the question is, what are some things that would affect your armor in such a game? Like, what are some things that would make, just sort of categories of things that would make you more or less convincible in a game? So that when I'm filling out sort of the equipment section in the game, here are some things that make me more self-assured as a person, so I'm less likely to be influenced. Like I can think of different persuasive techniques. Like here, I'm much better at making friends. Oh, here I'm much better at convincing someone in a debate format. But what I'm struggling with is, how should the defenses against those attacks work? Like I am part of a social club, and I am part of a band, so that means I'm a happy person, which means I'm harder to demand friendship out of, or, you know, like, I'm just sort of spitballing. What would defense against either attempt at friendship that you're trying to resist or debate look like in a game like that?
Social distance. The power discrepancy in terms of social status between the two parties. If we have the same social status, friendship is easy. But rhetoric is harder. By contrast, if I'm much higher social status, I should be using public opinion and hitting you with public opinion.
Okay.
Because I have a loud voice and you have a quiet voice. So... you have to change your tactics depending on the relative positioning socially between parties.
I like that.
I had a couple of very, very strange experiences a couple of weekends ago. So I worked at a comic convention over here. And this convention had some ructions a couple of years ago when there were two green rooms, one for guests who worked in TV and film, and one for guests who wrote books. One of the green rooms had furniture. It was not the one the authors had. So and it was very, very weird going back to it a couple of years later to see this group of authors all kind of clustered around one table going, is that the guy from Deadpool? And I think relevant to your game, that the point here is that maybe environment plays a role too. The green rooms are really weird for that kind of thing, because it's simultaneously a neutral space, and there's this very complex and nuanced kind of rules of engagement of, you're looking at your phone, do I talk to you or what? And at the same time, it's also a shared space. So certainly, depending on what kind of background you're going for, what kind of genre it maps onto, that's something which could shift situationally. And that might make, I have no cameras, but trust me, I am making air quotes, combat more fluid and more tied to location and perhaps to plot as well.
I like that.
One thing I wanted to highlight is you might want to take a look, if you haven't already, at Robin Law's Hillfolk or Hamlet's Hit Points, which is the theory behind that. It's sort of very relationship-oriented gaming, where you build out sort of the goals and desires of your character and how they relate to the goals and desires of other characters. Mm-hmm. In terms of convincing somebody to do something, it does sort of tie into what Jason mentioned about different status levels and being able to request or deny, grant, whatever, different things that would meet somebody's needs or wants.
Okay.
Certainly. Might give you some extra perspective, I guess, on it. It's been a while since I've read it, but it's good.
Another thing to pay attention to is the model that's presented in The King is Dead, Vincent Baker's latest. Because it handles social interactions in a very interesting way. Specifically, everything is like, I stab you in the face, do you allow me? And it's sort of those kinds of dynamics of, mm-hmm. I do X, are you fine with that?
Like consent at the table from the player side?
Yeah, so the player must consent to whatever the outcome is, functionally.
Yeah, that's,
or you can frame it as, I do X, what do you do to react to this? So it's an interesting social space. And consent is a very interesting space, because saying, here's social tactics that involve social force, and here's social tactics that involve agreement and both parties. In some things, you'll want to do the former, and some things you'll want to do the latter. Mm-hmm. And that can even wrap into issues of leadership and management styles. So are you an effective leader who's got a very authoritarian style? Do X, do Y. Or are you a more collaborative or more consultative style of person? And giving sort of leaning in those directions for how do people make other people do things might be a good direction if you're trying to model. Because, that's the one thing that you have in social dynamics that you don't have in combat. Because in combat, it's everyone agrees that I don't want to be stabbed in the face.
Right.
That's a base assumption, that I don't want to be stabbed in the face. In social situations, you can actually have we'll go for Indian. We're all good with going for Indian food, right? Okay, we're good.
Yeah, there's the setting the stakes and managing the player consent, like stakes in terms of, is it even possible to convince this character to, I don't know, like give me all his money? There are situations where that would be possible, and there would be situations where that would just be outside the range of like credibility for a particular character. And of course, we don't want to steal a player's ownership of another character. So those are things that I'm trying to navigate, and you're raising some good points. Like, I like the idea of thinking of it in terms of the analogy of leadership and management. My initial thought would be, as far as that goes, once I have all the basics of the system, the different classes could have very different approaches to, like, now that we know how, as players, to set the stakes for this conflict, and what does it look like when we win or lose, your character might aim to bludgeon me or buddy-buddy me in very different ways, depending on their abilities or their class or whatever. I like that.
You can also probably lift something from Dream Askew.
I always
just
do.
Just because Dream Askew.
Yes.
Just checking, Al and Alice and Andy, you both are fully aware and have bought in on that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I believe good. So.
Good.
Yes, I'm a fanboy. So, okay. Well, I feel helped. Let me say that out loud. If you can't tell from my polite exterior, I'm trying to viciously type notes with one hand off camera. Like, oh, that's a good idea. I think I do have Hamlet's hit points, and I also have not read it in a while, but it makes sense that that would be relevant game research.
Yeah, Hillfolk is sort of the implementation of the theory that's in Hamlet's hit points. So it's a good follow-up if you have access to that one as well.
I may or may not be in that book. Like half the industry.
Yeah, there's so much in that. And so many I forget what he calls the play sets. Settings? No. Anyway.
Yeah, I forget.
Series? I don't know.
I wrote one, but
yeah, there's so many of them. It's unbelievable. And then he had contests for more too, and they're all freely available. There are so many things.
That's a good gimmick. I should steal that.
Yeah, it's. I thought Fiasco had a lot of playsets.
Yeah.
Hill folks. So, how about you two? Now you have a team, so you kind of have this regularly happening. Josh and I don't, but so.
So one of the things that we're trying to do is so I'm as the GM, the rules that I've prepared are pretty much saying that the only time you roll the dice are when the characters are in conflict with the song or with the counter song that humans made up, because humans are clever monkeys and decided effectively saying, oh, you know that mind controlling orchestra? Let's make a death metal variant that will negate it and drown it out. That'll totally work out well. So that's called Tormenta. And it works about as well as you'd think. Functionally, the song is the psychic Borg, whereas Tormenta turns people into Reavers.
Right.
So, yeah. One of the challenges is how to... Because mechanically we have to have it limited to situations where the song or Tormenta are involved. Because effectively there's always the lose condition of if you lose in a conflict, the song or Tormenta will mind control you and change your beliefs. But that means that all of the antagonism has to be baked into the song and Tormenta, which makes for... So pretty much every all I have is a hammer and a screwdriver. So everything is a nail or a screw. And it leads to some challenges from a game design and direction. So, for instance, we had someone who was injured. And we had one of the characters who was a doctor who was trying to help and patch up that injured person. As the GM, my how well do they heal has to be, well, the song or Tormenta is involved. So I had the injured person being super creepy and like, oh, there, everything is fine. Do not worry about the injury. All is well within the song. Which worked, but it's kind of one-note-y.
Right.
So my current attempt is to effectively draw out the themes to make very low-level song being you're evasive and calm and social, whereas low-level Tormenta is your more rebellious and passionate. It's sort of to pull it back that way.
Oddly enough, I have a couple of ideas. The first one that strikes me is if one of the kind of possible issues is what happens when folks get injured and that there isn't really kind of mechanics there to deal with it, let's Mass Effect 1 this thing. You know, I am all in. I loved Omnigel. I miss Omnigel. You needed a lock picked, Omnigel. You needed a wound closed, Omnigel. You needed 1,000 calories in a hurry, Omnigel. You know, it might be interesting to kind of play with one of the aspects of the background, which is basically I wanted to kind of write Star Trek in hell, which is what this very much ended up being. There's not exactly a culture of plenty, but there are certain things which folks maybe don't have to worry about, like injuries up to a certain level. Whether we want to do, you know, nanite repairs or what, I'm not sure. But it might be worth kind of taking a leaf from the Gumshoe book on this one, almost, and going, is this something which is of primary concern? And if not, let's just streamline it a little bit.
I agree, but one of the challenges is when you have a frontier community,
mm-hmm.
having a doctor is kind of important from a social perspective.
Yeah, that is true.
So, look, you're the doctor, but you don't need to heal. You don't actually hit the mechanics. You just...
Yeah.
So, the soldier can be shooting someone, and that's a conflict, but healing someone... mechanically doesn't work.
Okay, well, I see the problem.
It might be interesting if, like, to take the Omnigel story, only one person is qualified to operate the Omnigel equipment.
Right, but then, so, the question is, does the Omnigel always work, in which case there's no difficulty / challenge, and therefore no uncertainty?
Right.
So I have some questions about the stakes. So in the situation that you are, is your example with the doctor and the injured person, like, does the story care whether how the person is injured? Like, is there a question that they may or may not be healed, or are they definitely going to be healed?
So... And I mean, that is the fundamental question. Is one of the ways that I've sort of tried to spin it has been, yes, you'll heal anyone, that's fine, but people might be infected.
Because one approach could be, and it kind of depends on what the stakes of the conflict as you imagine in the game are, like, you can make games where it doesn't matter whether someone dies or not. It matters whether they lose their mind. So it's like, as a loose analogy, just about any British doctor drama.
Yeah,
people like surgeries are not happening on screen. There may be some sort of the diagnosis might be part of the conflict, but the actual how it plays out, the doctor is much more likely, in my experience watching British medical drama, they're much more likely to be worried about having a fight with their neighbor or solving some murder mystery or something, just because the stakes of this story we're telling is not actually will this character die. It is the will I be accepted in the community, like sort of the social stuff you're talking about. So I'm not saying that is what you should do here. I'm saying it's okay to hand wave the medical treatment if that is not the fun thing that's at risk in this story. It's like, oh, and you're probably healed. Yeah.
So there's a lot of community dynamics that are going on. Of you're in effectively a small frontier village, and these people, these relationships, I wanted to feel like, the blacksmith is now had died in a terrible accident. Now we don't have anyone who can do our blacksmithing work, kind of thing. So the stakes of is this person, and preferably is this person you've got a relationship with, going to survive, feels like it's something that's actually meaningful in the broader context.
Okay.
And maybe I just need to loosen up the when the GM can offer opposition rules somewhat and pull it further away. But conceptually, I like the shtick of, yeah, no, the two mind controlling forces of effectively order and chaos. That's the opposition.
In terms of the diametrical opposites of order and chaos, you can, to some degree, you can spin the effects of that in all sorts of, the causes of that to generate all sorts of effects. I'm thinking of the fiction series by Ellie Modisett. Like, it's all about order and chaos. Like, those are the magical forces. Order-based wizards build stuff that's really strong. Chaos-based wizards destroy things. But to some degree, if you destroy the right thing, like right things, like microsurgery, you're making something stronger. Or if you build up the wrong things, things collapse and get destroyed. So you can get the same effects with different causes. One thing that I wanted to touch on is that you seem to be sort of attaching the two different types of songs to particular emotions, where we have community emotion versus anger and disorganization. There is one, it's a heavyweight, super academic, crazy book Lazarus called, oh, I forget the first name, Lazarus is the last name, Emotions and Adaptation. And it's older, textbook about how humans deal with emotional triggers and adapt to them in a philosophical, psychological point of view. Linking the songs to emotions and adaptations therein might be a compelling way to model things. Just a thought.
Yeah. That gives me a couple of potentially very complicated ideas.
Sorry.
So I was going to say, it sounds like maybe part of what we're talking about is if all conflict is sort of filtered thematically through the either the song or Tormenta, then it could be indirect influence. If I understand what Jason was saying, like, so it's not that I try to heal the doctor. I pull out either my Tormenta Band-Aid or my The Song Band-Aid, so much as it is like, if what is at risk is the well-being of the community, and then the danger is it is either moving in this crazy direction or this crazy direction if I fail. So
yep.
I like the idea. If that's sort of you're taking it, I like the idea of having sort of a list of like, okay, here's low stakes evidence, sort of like the zombies haven't fully shown up on screen right now, but we know that when this sort of thing happens, it's pushing the story in that bad direction. And when this sort of thing happens, it's pushing the story in that direction. So I like that idea of sort of the indirect influence of the two songs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that lines up a little bit more. Sorry, my laptop ran out of juice and I was desperately trying to plug it in.
We solved all your problems while you were gone.
Excellent. Yeah, so effectively saying, yeah, you healed them. Now we'll figure out what that actually does mechanically. Because bad things are going to happen 2 weeks later because of it.
Yeah, one thing I brought up while you were gone is there's a fictional series called by Ellie Modisett, where the magical forces in the world are order and chaos. But he definitely explores, at some point in the series, the fact that you can sort of create order-based or chaos-based results regardless of the source. So, for instance, with healing, you have if you have a broken bone, you could use order-based effects to regrow the tissue. You could use chaos-based effects to eliminate the broken shards of bone that are impinging the bone's ability to repair itself. So you can have different actions that result in the same.
Yeah.
So it's an analogy that might work well.
And one other potential venue is to simply say that if you are affected by, if you're injured, you become vulnerable psychically. So it's not, are you healed enough to not die? It's, are you healed enough that you don't become immunosuppressed from a psychological perspective?
That's interesting. Everything being a stressor, injury is a stressor.
And if I could give a qualified, not entirely optimistic movie recommendation, Jason, are you familiar with Transcendence?
Yep.
Yeah. I don't know that that's a great movie, but I do like the idea of we can heal you of anything, but like you were saying, .. 2 weeks later, you're going to regret it because you are now a mind controlled monster or whatever. Like that seems just as an on theme B movie for the feel you're going for.
Oh, definitely. And just as a quick aside, one of my, just to be clear, we are talking about the evil AI Johnny Depp movie. Yeah.
Yes.
The one that looks really interesting, and then there's obviously about an hour's worth of footage that they just completely hacked out of the middle to try and bring it in at 2 hours. Yeah. One of my favorite bits of world building is in the first 2 minutes of that film, and it's when Paul Bettany goes into the shop in Berkeley, and there is a laptop being used as the doorstop. And even before you find out what's happened, that's such a strong kind of, okay, this isn't normal. I really like that.
Yeah. And it's another movie where if you pay really close attention, you will be afraid of rain by the end of the movie. It's like, oh, that's a good sign that we're in some sort of apocalyptic environment if rain is scary.
Yes. Or children singing psalms.
Yes, yes. I do not default to that being scary, but in the right genre, that would terrify me.
The reason why children singing songs is so scary is you have to deal with the problem.
So like,
how do you deal with that problem?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Just feed them a different song.
Yeah, Tormenta is totally good.
Nursery rhymes. No one was ever frightened of nursery rhymes.
What's the I forget the name of the episode, but the Doctor Who, Are You My Mommy?
Yes.
Yeah, that's something. All right.
Wonderful.
So does that help out with
Yep, that,
yeah, that does.
That absolutely helps.
Absolutely. Great. All right. So I think that's kind of our schedule. Let's go through and just sort of call out where people can find us and find our games, follow us, all that good stuff. Once again, we'll just do typical Google Hangouts left to right, nice and easy. Al.
Okay. You can find me online at alistairstewart.com. That's also conveniently my Twitter handle. I write pop culture analysis for Tor.com, Barnes & Noble, and NYM Buzz. NYM Buzz, pardon me. And you can find all the games I've done, including the tiny, tiny little, here are five alien races you could potentially use, that I did about 8 years ago, all on DriveThruRPG.
Cool. Jason.
You can find me at genesisoflegend.com, and we also have our work over on drivethroughrpg.com, where we've got a wide variety of things, including my Sad Wizards game, Circles of Power. Ding!
Excellent. You can find me at Josh T. Jordan on Twitter or joshtjordan.com. And of course, Drive Through RPG as well. And I would strongly encourage you, if you are at all interested in my games, to pick the weirdest one that sounds interesting. That is always good advice, because it's probably me trying to preach at you about some game theory point, but I bet you will have fun, and I guarantee it will not be the same as all of the other PDFs that you've got sitting on your hard drive right now.
Beautiful. I'm Andy Burdan. You can find me at burdan.ca for my personal stuff. But for my game development stuff, burdandy.com. Just take the two names and squish them together. And that'll take you to all the good things. You can find the show at gmparty.com. And there's a Patreon link for patreon.com/gmparty where you can kick money at the show and I can get better equipment and make something better than Google Hangouts someday, eventually, maybe. I hope. It'd be nice. It's okay, but
yeah.
It's been a great great show, and I hope everybody had a good time.
Yes, thank you.
Absolutely, fantastic. Thank you very much.
Beautiful. And that's a wrap.